Chapter 42. Tenderness, since its nullification could do no good. Thus she held self-communion in her seat in the coach, passing through Casterbridge, and Shottsford, and on to the white-hearted Melchester, at which place the whole fabric of her recent intentions crumbled down. Better be staunch having got so far, let things take their course, and marry boldly the man who had so impressed her. How great he was, how small was she, and as he had presumed to judge him. Abandoning her place in the coach with the precipitancy that had characterized her taking it, she waited till the vehicle had driven off, something in the departing shapes of the outside passengers against the starlit sky giving her a start, as she afterwards remembered. Presently the down coach, the Morning Herald, entered the city, and as he hastily obtained a place on the top. "I'll be firm, I'll be his, if it cost me my immortal soul," she said. And with troubled breathings she journeyed back over the road as he had just traced. She reached our royal watering place by the time the day broke, and her first aim was to get back to the hired room in which her last few days had been spent, when the landlady appeared at the door in response to Mademoiselle 5's nervous summons. She explained her sudden departure and return as best she could, and no objection being offered to her re-engagement of the room for one day longer, she ascended to the chamber and sat down panting. She was back once more, and her wild tergiversations were a secret from him whom alone they concerned. A sealed letter was on the mantelpiece. "S, it is directed to you, Mademoiselle," said the woman who had followed her. "But we were wondering what to do with it. A town messenger brought it after you had gone last night." When the landlady had left, Mademoiselle 5 opened the letter and read, "My dear and honored friend, you have been throughout our acquaintance absolutely candid concerning your misgivings. But I have been reserved concerning mine. That is the difference between us. You probably have not guessed that every qualm you have felt on the subject of our marriage has been paralleled in my heart to the full. Thus it happened that your involuntary outburst of remorse yesterday, though mechanically deprecated by me in your presence, was a last item in my own doubts on the wisdom of our union, giving them a force that I could no longer withstand. I came home, and, on reflection, much as I honor and adore you, I decide to set you free. As one whose life has been devoted, and I may say sacrificed, to the cause of liberty, I cannot allow your judgment, probably a permanent one, to be fettered beyond release by a feeling which may be transient only. It would be no less than excruciating to both that I should announce this decision to you by word of mouth. I have therefore taken the less painful course of writing. Before you receive this, I shall have left the town by the evening coach for London, on reaching which city my movements will be revealed to none. Regard me, Mademoiselle, as dead, and accept my renewed assurances of respect, remembrance, and affection." When as he had recovered from her shock of surprise and grief, she remembered that at the starting of the coach out of Melchester before dawn, the shape of a figure among the outside passengers against the starlit sky had caused her a momentary start, from its resemblance to that of her friend. Knowing nothing of each other's intentions, and screened from each other by the darkness, they had left the town by the same conveyance. E, the greater, persevered. I, the smaller, returned, she said. Recovering from her stupor, Mademoiselle 5 bethought herself again of her employer, Mrs. Newbold, whom recent events had estranged. To that lady she went with a full heart, and explained everything. Mrs. Newbold kept to herself her opinion of the episode, and reinstalled the deserted bride in her old position as governess to the family. A governess she remained to the end of her days. After the final peace with France she became acquainted with my mother, to whom by degrees she imparted these experiences of hers. As her hair grew white, and her features pinched, Mademoiselle 5 would wonder what nook of the world contained her lover, if he lived, and if by any chance she might see him again. But when, sometime in the 20s, Death came to her, at no great age, that outline against the stars of the morning remained as the last glimpse she ever obtained of her family's foe and her once affianced husband. ...1895. Master John Horsley, Knight. In the earliest and mustiest volume of the Havenpool Marriage Registers, said the thin-faced gentleman, this entry may still be read by anyone curious enough to decipher the crabbed handwriting of the date. I took a copy of it when I was last there, and it runs thus. He had opened his pocketbook and now read aloud the extract, afterwards handing round the book to us, wherein we saw transcribed the following: Master John Horsley, Knit, of the Piss of Clifton, was married to Edith the Whiff laid off John Stalker, Mchant of Havenpool, the ZH Dage of December, be Vilek Jevon by our subhead of the Church of Injiland Kinch Henry the Vi ith 1539. Now, if you turn to the long and elaborate pedigree of the ancient family of the Horsleys of Clifton Horsley, you will find no mention whatever of this alliance, notwithstanding the privilege given by the sovereign and head of the church, the said Sir John being there chronicled as marrying, at a date apparently earlier than the above, the daughter and heiress of Richard Phillipson, of Montislip, in Nether Wessex, a lady who outlived him, of which marriage there were issue two daughters and a son, who succeeded him in his estates. How are we to account for these, as it would seem, contemporaneous wives? A strange local tradition only can help us, and this can be briefly told. One evening in the autumn of the year 1540 or 1541, a young sailor, whose Christian name was Roger, but whose surname is not known, landed at his native place of Havenpool, on the South Wessex coast, after a voyage in the Newfoundland trade, then newly sprung into existence. He returned in the ship Primrose with a cargo of train oil brought home from the Newfoundland, ... from the town records of the date. During his absence of two summers and a winter, which made up the term of a Newfoundland spell, ... many unlooked-for changes had occurred within the quiet little seaport, some of which closely affected Roger the sailor. At the time of his departure, his only sister Edith had become the bride of one Stalker, a respectable townsman, and part owner of the brig in which Roger had sailed, and it was to the house of this couple, his only relatives, that the young man directed his steps. On trying the door in case treaty, found it locked, and then observed that the windows were boarded up. Inquiring of a bystander, he learnt for the first time of the death of his brother-in-law, though that event had taken place nearly 18 months before. And my sister Edith? ... asked Roger. She's married again, as they do say, and hath been so these 12 months. I don't vouch for the truth of't, though if she isn't, she ought to be. ... Roger's face grew dark. He was a man with a considerable reserve of strong passion, and he asked his informant what he meant by speaking thus. The man explained that shortly after the young woman's bereavement, a stranger had come to the port. He had seen her moping on the quay, had been attracted by her youth and loneliness, and in an extraordinarily brief wooing had completely fascinated her, had carried her off, and, as was reported, had married her. Though he had come by water, he was supposed to live no very great distance off by land. They were last heard of at Ouswood, in Upper Wessex, at the house of one Wall, a timber merchant, where, he believed, she still had a lodging, though her husband, if he were lawfully that much, was but an occasional visitor to the place. The stranger? ... asked Roger. Did you see him? What manner of man was he? ... I liked him not, said the other. He seemed of that kind, that hath something to conceal, and as he walked with her, he ever and anon turned his head and gazed behind him, as if he much feared an unwelcome pursuer. But, faith, continued he, it may have been the man's anxiety only. Yet did I not like him. Was he older than my sister? ... Roger asked. A much older, from a dozen to a score of years older. A man of some position, maybe, playing an amorous game for the pleasure of the hour. Who knoweth but that he have a wife already? Many have done the thing hereabouts of late. Having paid a visit to the graves of his relatives, the sailor next day went along the straight road which, then a lane, now a highway, conducted to the curious little inland town named by the Haven Pool Man. It is unnecessary to describe Oozewood on the South Avon. It has a railway at the present day, but 30 years of steam traffic past its precincts have hardly modified its original features. Surrounded by a sort of freshwater lagoon, dividing it from meadows and coppice, its ancient thatch and timber houses have barely made way even in the front street for the ubiquitous modern brick and slate. It neither increases nor diminishes in size. It is difficult to say what the inhabitants find to do, for, though trades in woodware are still carried on, there cannot be enough of this class of work nowadays to maintain all the householders, the forests around having been so greatly thinned and curtailed. At the time of this tradition the forests were dense, artificers in wood abounded, and the timber trade was brisk. Every house in the town, without exception, was of oak framework, filled in with plaster, and covered with thatch, the chimney being the only brick portion of the structure. Inquiry soon brought Roger the sailor to the door of wall, the timber dealer referred to, but it was some time before he was able to gain admission to the lodging of his sister, the people having plainly received directions not to welcome strangers. She was sitting in an upper room on one of the lath-backed, willow-bottomed shepherd's chairs, made on the spot then, as to this day, and as they were probably made there in the days of the heptarchy. In her lap was an infant, which as he had been suckling, though now it had fallen asleep, so at the young mother herself for a few minutes, under the drowsing effects of solitude. Hearing footsteps on the stairs, she awoke, started up with a glad cry, and ran to the door, opening which she met her brother on the threshold. "Oh, this is Mary, I didn't expect thee." She said. "Ah, Roger, I thought it was John." Her tones fell to disappointment. The sailor kissed her, looked at her sternly for a few moments, and pointing to the infant, said, "You mean the father of this?" "Yes, my husband," said Edith. "I hope so," he answered. "Why, Roger, I'm married of a truth am I?" she cried. "Shame upon thee, if true. If not true, worse. Master Stocker was an honest man, and he should have respected his memory longer. Where is thy husband?" "He comes often. I thought it was he now. Our marriage has to be kept secret for a while. It was done privily for certain reasons, but we was married at church like honest folk afore God we were, Roger, 6 months after poor Stocker's death." "'Twas too soon," said Roger. "I was living in a house alone. I had nowhere to go to. You were far oversea in the Newfoundland, and John took me, and brought me here." "How often doth he come?" Says Roger again. "Once or twice weekly," says she. "I wished THDST waited till I returned. Dear Edie," he said. "It mid be you are a wife, I hope so. But, if so, why this mystery? Why this mean and cramped lodging in this lonely copse-circled town? Of what standing is your husband, and of where?" "He is of gentle breeding, his name is John. I am not free to tell his family name. He is said to be of London, for safety's sake, but he really lives in the county next adjoining this." "Where in the next county?" "I do not know. He has preferred not to tell me, that I may not have the secret forced from me, to his and my hurt, by bringing the marriage to the ears of his kinsfolk and friends." Her brother's face flushed. "Our people have been honest townsmen, well reputed for long. Why should you readily take such humbling from a sojourner, of whom THST know nothing, apostrophe apostrophe, they remained in constrained converse till her quick ear caught a sound, for which she might have been waiting a horse's footfall. It is John. Apostrophe apostrophe, said she. This is his night Saturday. Apostrophe, don't be frightened lest he should find me here. Apostrophe apostrophe, said Roger. I am on the point of leaving. I wish not to be a third party. Say nothing at all about my visit, if it will incommode you so to do. I will see he, before I go afloat again. Apostrophe apostrophe, speaking thus he left the room, and descending the staircase let himself out by the front door, thinking he might obtain a glimpse of the approaching horseman. But that traveler had in the meantime gone stealthily round to the back of the homestead, and peering along the pinion end of the house Roger discerned him unbridling, and haltering his horse with his own hands in the shed there. Roger retired to the neighboring inn called the Black Lamb, and meditated. This mysterious method of approach determined him, after all, not to leave the place till he had ascertained more definite facts of his sister's position, whether she were the deluded victim of the stranger, or the wife she obviously believed herself to be. Having eaten some supper, he left the inn, it being now about 11 o'clock. He first looked into the shed, and, finding the horse still standing there, waited irresolutely near the door of his sister's lodging. Half an hour lapsed, and, while thinking he would climb into a loft hard by for a night's rest, there seemed to be a movement within the shutters of the sitting room that his sister occupied. Roger hid himself behind a faggot stack near the back door, rightly divining that his sister's visitor would emerge by the way he had entered. The door opened, and the candle she held in her hand lighted for a moment the stranger's form, showing it to be that of a tall and handsome personage, about 40 years of age, and apparently of a superior position in life. Edith was assisting him to cloak himself, which being done he took leave of her with a kiss and left the house. From the door she watched him bridle and saddle his horse, and having mounted, and waved an adieu to her as she stood candle in hand, he turned out of the yard and rode away. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.